Welcome to Life in Debt, your practical debt education program. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, an award-winning, listener-supported, open-source, grassroots, and partially solar-powered community radio station broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield. Please note that these presentations are provided as a public service for general information purposes only and are not intended to be legal opinions, legal advice, or complete discussions of any legal issues. Remember, every individual's factual situation is different, and you should seek independent legal advice from an attorney familiar with the laws of your state or locality regarding specific information. The name of the show is Life in Debt, and it is a weekly half-hour educational show looking at all types of issues related to debt as it influences your life. The show provides practical, general knowledge about what to look for regarding debt, what are traps and pitfalls, and what to do to be an educated debtor. Please get some notebook paper and a pen to take notes during the show. We start by looking at some debt-related news and facts for the week. From the New York Times by Peter Goodman, Peddling Relief, Firms Put Debtors in Deeper Hole. For companies that promise relief to Americans confronting swelling credit card balances, these are days of lucrative opportunity. So lucrative that an industry trade association, the United States Organizations for Bankruptcy Alternatives, recently convened in Florida in the oceanfront confines of the Four Seasons Resort to forge deals and plot strategy. At a well-lubricated evening reception, a steel drum band played Bob Marley songs as hostesses in skimpy dresses draped leis around the necks of arriving entrepreneurs, some with deep tans. The debt settlement industry can afford some extravagance. The long recession has delivered an abundance of customers, debt-saturated Americans, suffering lost jobs and income, sliding toward bankruptcy. The settlement companies typically harvest fees reaching 15 to 20% of the credit card balances carried by their customers, and they tend to collect upfront, regardless of whether a customer's debt is actually reduced. State attorneys general from New York to California and consumer watchdogs like the Better Business Bureau say the industry's proceeds come at the direct expense of financially troubled Americans who are being fleeced of their last dollars with dubious promises. Consumers rarely emerge from debt settlement programs with their credit card balances eliminated, these critics say, and many wind up worse off with severely damaged credit, ceaseless threats from collection agents, and lawsuits from creditors. In the Kansas City area, Linda Robertson, 58, rues the day she bought the pitch from a debt settlement company advertising on the radio, promising to spare her from bankruptcy and eliminate her debts. She wound up sending nearly $4,000 into a special account established under the company's guidance before a credit card company sued her, prompting her to drop out of the program. By then, her account had only $1,470 remaining. The debt settlement company had collected the rest in fees. She is now filing for bankruptcy. They take advantage of vulnerable people, she said. When you're desperate and you're trying to get out of debt, they take advantage of you. Debt settlement has swollen to some 2,000 firms from a niche of perhaps a dozen companies a decade ago, according to trade associations and the Federal Trade Commission, which is completing new rules aimed at curbing abuses within the industry. Last year, within the industry's two leading trade associations, the United States Organizations for Bankruptcy Alternatives and the Association of Settlement Companies, some 250 companies collectively had more than 425,000 customers who had enrolled roughly $11.7 billion in credit card balances in their programs. As the industry has grown, so have allegations of unfair practices. Since 2004, at least 21 states have brought at least 121 enforcement actions against debt relief companies, according to the National Association of Attorneys General. consumer complaints received by states more than doubled between 2007 and 2009, according to comments filed with the Federal Trade Commission. The industry's not legitimate, said Norman Google, Assistant Attorney General in West Virginia, who has prosecuted debt settlement companies. They're targeting a group of people who are already drowning in debt. We're talking about middle class and lower class people who had incomes, but they were using credit cards to survive. The industry counters that a few rogue operators have unfairly tarnished the reputations of well-intentioned debt settlement companies that provide a crucial service, liberating Americans from impossible credit card burdens. With the unemployment rate near double digits and 6.7 million people out of work for 6 months or longer, many have relied on credit cards. By the middle of last year, 6.5% of all accounts were at least 30 days past due, up from less than 4% in 2005, according to Moody'sEconomy.com. Yet a 2005 alteration, spurred by the financial industry, made it harder for Americans to discharge credit card debts through bankruptcy, generating demand for alternatives like debt settlement. The industry casts itself as a victim of a smear campaign orchestrated by the giant banks that dominate the credit card trade and aim to hang on to the spoils, interest rates of 20% or more, and exorbitant late fees. We're the little guys in this, said John Ainsbach, the chief lobbyist for the United States Organization for Bankruptcy Alternatives, better known as USOBA, or USOBA. We exist to advocate for consumers. $2.5 billion of unsecured debt have been settled by this industry, so how can you take the position that it has no value? But consumer watchdogs and state authorities argue that debt settlement companies generally fail to deliver. In the typical arrangement, the companies direct consumers to set up special accounts and stock them with monthly deposits while skipping their credit card payments. Once balances reach sufficient size, negotiators strike lump sum settlements with credit card companies that can cut debts in half. The programs generally last 2 to 3 years. What they don't tell their customers is when you stop sending the money, creditors get angry, said Andrew Pizer, a staff lawyer at the National Consumer Law Center. Collection agents call. Sometimes they sue. People think they're settling their problems and getting some relief, and lo and behold, they get slammed with a lawsuit. In a case of two debt settlement companies sued last year by New York State, the Attorney General alleged that no more than 1% of customers gained the services promised by the marketers. A Colorado investigation came to a similar conclusion. The industry's own figures show that clients typically fail to secure relief. In a survey of its members, the Association of Settlement Companies found that 3 years after enrolling, only 34% of customers had either completed programs or were still saving for settlements. The industry is designed almost as a Ponzi scheme, said Scott Johnson, chief executive of U.S. Debt Resolve, a debt settlement company based in Dallas, which he portrays as a rare island of integrity in a sea of shady competitors. Consumers come into these programs and pay thousands of dollars, and then nothing happens. What they constantly have is more consumers coming into the program to come up with the money for more marketing. And we will continue this article next week on debt settlement companies. If you're just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and this program is Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. So continuing this week, we are with The Two-Income Trap by Professor Elizabeth Warren from Harvard and her daughter Amelia Warren Tiagi. And we have been discussing why middle-class parents are going broke and some breakthrough solutions for the dilemma. As a start, there is a credit because the thoughts, ideas, and example used in this program are directly from or based on the work, theories, and books of Professor Elizabeth Warren and her daughter Amelia Warren Tyagi, who are two of America's leading champions for debtors. I highly recommend their books, All Your Worth and The Two Income Trap. And you can also listen to all of the shows which have been produced in the area of debt by going to www.kruufm.com. Go to the archives under Life and Debt. Last week, I was bringing up the point of regulation for lending institutions. And Professor Warren and Amelia brought out the point that the government regulates the sale of millions of products, everything from children's pajamas to aspirin to automobiles, to protect consumers from the risks of substantial injury. For most of America's history, loans to consumers fell squarely within that definition. Interest rates and other terms were carefully limited by state legislatures and patrolled when necessary by state attorney generals. Predatory loans may not set houses on fire the way a faulty toaster might, but they steal people's homes all the same. America has had more than 20 years, actually now more than 30 years, to observe the effects of a deregulated lending industry, and the evidence is overwhelming. It's time to call the experiment a failure, and these are the words of Professor Warren. And of course, if you listen to the news up front in my show, you see that there's a lot of corroboration for the mire caused to consumers by lack of regulation. So we are promoting re-regulation. Now, re-regulation would help solve a litany of evils. The most important is worth its own headline. Limiting interest rates would halt the rapid rise in home foreclosures. With a lower ceiling on interest rates, lenders would lead the charge to reestablish an appropriate match between family income and mortgage size, which would have the effect of reducing the mass of families that are sucked into mortgages they have no hope of paying. Minority communities would no longer find themselves stripped of wealth by predatory subprime lenders. And homeowners would no longer be suckered into second and third mortgages that promised to lower their monthly bills, but that actually robbed them of the family home to the level of 80% of all the mortgage foreclosures that we read about. Now, interest rate regulation would also take the ammunition out of the middle class bidding war, which we've discussed in the past, helping to save families from the two-income trap. This is based on competition for the best neighborhoods with the best schools, and competition for the best neighborhoods would continue, but if no one could get a mortgage that ate up 40%, 50% of the family's entire income, which is happening, then home prices would begin to settle down to earth. To many economists, this kind of notion is really scandalous, involving a reduction in Americans' net worth. But as Professor Warren points out, net worth isn't worth anything unless a family plans to sell its home and live in a cave, because the next house the family buys would carry a similarly outrageous price tag. Some families with weaker credit histories or more modest incomes might find themselves limited to smaller homes, but they would be also far less likely to end up in a home that drove them into bankruptcy court. Also, as housing prices start to level off, more families would be able to afford a home without having to resort to a subprime mortgage. Re-regulation of interest rates would bring relief to all families, not just to those already in serious trouble. Families would also be far less likely to get into trouble with their credit cards. With appropriate limits on interest rates, banks would still be able to issue credit cards profitably, and consumers would still have access to those convenient plastic cards, although I am very much against it. But banks would have far greater incentive to screen cardholders offering only as much credit as each family could repay. There would be no incentive to single out families in financial trouble, tempting them at the moment when they are most vulnerable with special offers of extra credit at exorbitant rates. Banks would have no reason to scour credit records looking for homeowners in trouble, offering to solve their credit problems by putting their homes at risk through second or third mortgages. So there is a very sound logic to all of this. And the limits on interest rates would reverse another disturbing trend. That's the transfer of wealth from lower and middle class income families. Since 1970, banking profits, inflation adjusted, have more than tripled, growing beyond $50 billion. Those profits weren't the rewards for important innovations. The lenders didn't invent a faster computer, design a better car, or make a new movie that everyone wanted to see. Many people actually argue that the quality of banking service declined during this period. Turns out that they sold pretty much the same thing they always had, debt. The difference was that they sold more of it and they charged higher prices. And as I pointed out in the past, much of that debt is instantaneously sold off into a portfolio and the originating lender becomes a servicer, which makes most of its money on people struggling, interest rates going up, late fees, penalties, all of these added charges going to the servicer. Professor Warren and Amelia give a modest example, an example of what is happening to American families. She uses credit card companies, which basically have three costs: marketing costs, collection costs, and the cost to borrow the money that they will relend to consumers. The Federal Reserve lowered interest rates 9 times in the year 2001, which meant that the credit card company's cost of borrowing fell considerably low. Even so, they held steady the rates they charged for most of their cardholders. No change there. The result? A $10 billion windfall for the credit card companies. Nothing was given back to the consumer. Nothing changed in the way these companies did business. Their marketing costs stayed the same. Their collection costs stayed the same. And their products stayed the same. The only difference was that their already high profits jumped by an additional $10 billion in the year 2001. And that $10 billion was paid by families across the country. $10 billion that might have paid for medical bills or college tuition, school shoes, car repairs, or even paid down the balances of outstanding loans. So just by way of example, in 1 year, $10 billion of extra cash disappeared from families' wallets and reappeared on the balance sheets of a handful of corporate lenders. Families got nothing in return. They paid out dollars that, if the interest rates had been regulated, would have belonged to them. If you're just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and this program is Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. So back to regulation of the lending industry. Professor Warren says that regulation would eliminate the worst abuses of a lending industry run amok. Payday lenders would no longer target minority neighborhoods with short-term loans at interest rates of 100%, 500%, and we've even seen 1,000% rates that would make any mobster drool. The more subtle forms of loan sharking would also disappear, so that when the families managed to get into trouble with credit card debt, lenders would no longer be able to prey on their desperation by doubling the interest rates and piling on the late fees that turn their debts into financial quicksand. Now, what about the family's access to credit? deregulation of the mortgage lending industry was not a right-wing conspiracy. It was actually supported by most Democrats as well. Many liberals got behind the move for traditionally liberal reasons. They wanted to defend lower-income families. They had been persuaded that the risks posed by the over-aggressive lenders might not be as dangerous as once was thought. A deregulated lending market could even prove to be a critical tool to help low-income and disadvantaged families improve their lot. After all, working-class families needed credit to start businesses, to build homes, to send their kids to college, things that upper-income families had long had plenty of opportunities to do. There was also a growing body of evidence that even though it was illegal, overt discrimination and redlining, the practice which mortgage lenders refused to lend in certain neighborhoods, was crippling the housing markets in minority neighborhoods and denying low and moderate income families the chance to build wealth through home ownership. The new solution was to democratize credit, making credit available to anyone and everyone, no matter how poor. The prediction was for a more perfect world in which home ownership rates would go up, a sluggish economy would begin to boom, and cities would blossom, all thanks to the free flow of credit. Sounds attractive. Well, as we know today, the perfect world didn't come to pass. And we're still seeing this. If the politicians are questioned, they show a sign of worry. If America turns back the clock on lending regulation, what will happen to the home ownership rate? Well, we see what is happening. Every time anyone talks about putting restrictions on interest rates, the lending industry puts up one of those heartwarming advertisements that show a family with kids and a dog moving into their first home. But as we've pointed out before, the hard numbers belie those happy ads. Re-regulation of interest rates would have very little effect on home ownership rates. Since the mortgage industry was deregulated in 1980, and up to the point when this book was written, before the current recession, the proportion of families owning their own homes has increased by less than 3 percentage points. Plenty of factors contributed to those modest overall gains, such as long-running economic boom back then, the aging of the population, and a falling inflation rate. And those factors won't be affected by changes to mortgage regulations. And since most high-interest subprime mortgages are used for refinancing, not for families trying to buy their first homes, as I've pointed out on a number of occasions, outlawing those mortgages should have little effect on the number of first-time home buyers. In fact, if fewer families were pushed out of their homes by creditors intent on raking in profits through loan-to-own kind of scams and predatory practices, the overall number of homeowners in America might have been higher. So what about the democratization of credit for which activists fought so hard? Now, if interest rates are regulated once again, will credit become undemocratic, available only to those with realistic prospects for repayment? Professor Warren says, to answer this, it's time to step back a moment. The original intent of credit democratization movement was for credit to help more families become financially independent. Credit was not supposed to be an end in itself. But it seems that the original intent has been forgotten. Consider, for example, the motto of one prominent advocacy group: access to credit and capital is a basic civil right. Well, is it a civil right to pay interest on credit card balance for the rest of a person's natural life? A family that finances its home with a subprime mortgage can end up paying twice as much for that home as a family that gets the market rate. So is it a basic civil right to pay double for a home? I don't think so. And foreclosure rates, we know, are skyrocketing. Is it a civil right to lose that home in a sheriff's auction? Certainly not. The dream of democratization of credit was to use credit as a vehicle to expand home ownership, to launch businesses, and ultimately to help build wealth in neighborhoods that are short on it. The point was not to bombard families with more credit than they could possibly afford, or to flood the market with complicated loans that only a CPA could understand. But the mantra of expanding access to credit has been hard for consumer activists and politicians to abandon, and it's still in existence even after this recession has harmed so many Americans. We see that reform efforts have fragmented into a patchwork of measures intended to curb predatory lending practices. Yet the problem is that no one really is agreeing on how to define predatory lending, and I see this in cases all the time. As The Economist dryly observes, as with pornography, consumer activists and legislators say they know predatory lending when they see it. The National Housing Institute defines predatory lending as any unfair credit practice that harms the borrower or supports a credit system that promotes inequality and poverty. But Professor Warren says, what constitutes unfair? And who decides whether a system is promoting inequality or poverty? So attempting to stamp out predatory and unfair practices is certainly better than ignoring them, but it puts legislators in the position of trying to uncover the latest shenanigans and redefine abuses, always two steps behind the lenders who keep changing their products to sidestep regulations and law, as we've seen already happen since the new credit card law went into effect. It gives far too much room for lenders to circumvent the intent of the law. Back at the turn of the century, the New York State Banking Department banned unaffordable loans, except under compelling circumstances. Any crafty loan marketer could dream up some compelling circumstances that would permit a lender to sell overpriced loans. The only way to stop predatory lending once and for all was to go directly to the heart of the loan, the interest rate, and that has not happened. Limiting the amount of interest that creditors can charge avoids the hide-and-seek game over what is and what is not predatory, offering instead a simple, effective means of regulation. In essence, in order to achieve the real dream of credit democratization, it is time to recognize that families are not better off getting credit at double, triple, or even 10 times the market rate. If a family does not have the income to qualify for a loan at a reasonable rate, they should not get that loan. It does no one any favors to impose a modern-day debtor's prison on hard-working families. They would be better off renting an apartment and putting whatever extra money they have into savings accounts rather than paying double the market rate for a mortgage. If the private market cannot meet the needs of all communities, then it may be necessary for the government to step in to provide alternative sources of credit. The point worth emphasizing is that overpriced credit is no solution. Getting robbed to buy a home or to get a cash advance is still getting robbed, and it should be illegal. And next week, we will look at the fact that really politicians have done nothing substantial to deal with America's crippling addiction to debt, which could be shaken off with a simple regulatory change. So that'll be next week. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you have been listening to Life and Debt, your debt education program. If you have any questions or comments, call the station at 641-209-1083, or you can email me at lifeanddebt@gmail.com. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. May you enjoy and have a healthy and prosperous debt manageable life.